You come into church on Sunday morning and things are a little different. After uttering a loud, strange incantation, the minister steps forward and slaughters a bull which he happens to have brought with him. It gets even more bizarre. He collects the bull's blood in bowls, burns the entrails on a copper fire, then turns and, wait for it, throws the blood all over the congregation. Nice. Then an elder brings in two goats, slaughters one, releases the other, having symbolically laid the sins of the congregation on its head. Interesting, but not very Church of Scotland. When our daughter Sarah, presently great with child, began a course of study in social anthropology, when people asked me what that is, social anthropology, I hadn't much of a clue. She was the first social anthropologist in our family. I'm pretty sure, though, it's got something to do with how societies develop and how different cultural traditions evolve. One thing is for sure, the tradition of sacrifices has been in all cultures over the span of the centuries. Big in all cultures. They've been at it, Druids and Jews, Incas and Indians, South Sea Islanders and Africans. It probably meant different things to different people. For some, the sacrifices were offered to appease, to buy off with, win the favour of some angry, threatening deity. For some, sacrifices were just a chance to celebrate a successful harvest, a great victory, a wedding. And part of the sacrifice would be offered to the gods and the rest eaten by the merrymakers. The Bible, in Old and New Testaments, is bulging with talk, imagery, action to do with sacrifices, rules and cultic rituals. The pages of the Bible are soaked in the blood of sacrifices. So we really ought to know what it's all about, why it seemed to be such a feature of the thinking of those early opinion formers within the Judeo-Christian worldview. Many of the familiar ideas, the metaphors and the responses to crisis found in all cultures are found in the Bible's rituals and rites. They were used as pledges of unity between tribes and nations. That's a sacrifice to show we really mean it. There were signs that warring factions were at last prepared to make peace. And in the worship of the nation, they were somehow understood as a way of doing honour to your God. Inevitably, the cultic paraphernalia of religion, with its ranks of priests, its holy utensils and sacred vestments, all tended to lead to a bit of superstition and mumbo-jumbo. And if we want to see the point and the purpose of the idea of sacrifice as a key element in the story of religion, as telling us something important about how we do religion, we need to cut through all that hocus-pocus to what it really meant, what it suggested or signposted. Because it's inescapably there, whether we feel uncomfortable about it or not, filtering into our Christian understanding, our liturgy, our hymnology. It's at the core of much of Christian art. It shapes the way churches for centuries have been designed, with altars right there at the centre of what was done. And it certainly is fundamental to traditional theology, how we've understood our faith and what meaning we attribute to the life and death of Jesus. And, as we know, the greatest and the best hymns tremble with the imagery of sacrifice. We may not know, we cannot tell what pains he had to bear, but we believe it was for us he hung and suffered there. While some of the more obscure origins of the practice of sacrifices will remain lost in time, we still really need to know what it's all about and how that archaic idea might be meaningful even for us now. It's clear from the background that in the early days of human development and in the raw beginnings of the experience of men and women in the Bible, the practice of sacrifice was random and occasional. It was up to individuals or to tribes or to families how they practiced the business of sacrifices, when they thought it was an appropriate response, and what level of sacrifice a particular situation called for or merited. It was only much later, as the buildings of the magnificent temple in Jerusalem led to a centralized religious focus with a hierarchy of professional priests, it was only then that the sacrifice thing became structured and codified, specific and defined. And then in 70 AD, when the great temple of Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, the whole sacrificial system became unmanageable and impossible, and it pretty much died out after the fall of Jerusalem. The practice of the burnt offering or the Holocaust ceased until it reappeared in a quite different form in Europe in the 1930s. So come on, what on earth is going on with this sacrificing animals business? Why does it have such a central place in the Bible, and why has it had such a central place in Christian thinking? And what, if anything, has it to say to people like us, living in a world like ours, thinking the way we do? Well, it's about being serious about your religion. Being serious about your religion. Because it was costly. Keeping the sacrificial practice going was immensely costly. You might even think wasteful. It was always the best animals, the ones without a blemish, that had to be presented in the act of sacrifice. Not any old scabby sheep that you didn't really want anyway. You had to demonstrate that nothing but the best would do for God, and that you were willing to carry the cost of that devotion. And not just give him the fag end of your resources, but the cream of who you were and what you had. The market in spotless lambs, sheep, bulls and goats spawned a serious industry. By definition, sacrifice don't come cheap. It was also immensely inconvenient. Doing it, going to the temple, sustaining the machinery, keeping it all well-oiled and efficient was an exhausting and a demanding enterprise. By definition, there is no such thing as an easy, convenient sacrifice. And it was somber by its very nature, all this death and blood and the terrified squeals of the animals sensing death was near. It was a somber business. You only went down that road, engaged in that activity, if you meant business, if you appreciated that thinking about these things mattered a great deal. The nominal, casual, dilettante, not really fussed sort of individual wouldn't be bothered with all that stuff. But those who were serious about it and acknowledged it was a serious business, they did it. So the bottom line, sacrifices and sacrificing was at the very least to do with being serious about your religion. It's also about being serious about sin. Now, for the Jews and for the church, the problem of sin is a real and a terrible issue. It's the big issue. Because of what it does to individuals and how it robs them of joy and real life, because of the way it wrecks society and brings hurt and loss and damage, but most of all, because of the way it makes us distance ourselves from God. So sin is not a minor glitch or even a joke for a stand-up comedian. It's a disaster. And anyone who doesn't see that must have chosen to be blind to the truth. It does harm to individuals, it messes up society, and it puts a gulf between us and God. And so it's because sin is real and corrosive and dangerous, and not a myth, but a bitter reality, that the Bible is clear, there can be no easy fix. The people of the Bible understood that so indelible is sin in the human soul that the people could do nothing themselves to erase it, to remove the obstacle between themselves and God. The people of the Old and New Testament, they saw that. They appreciated the nature of the crisis in which our sinful attitudes and actions, into which they had plunged us. So sin is not a joke, it's not a game. Sin is death, sin is separation, sin is chaos. Just read your morning paper. And the system of sacrifices is a costly answer they saw as provided by God as an act of grace to show us beyond doubt or peradventure what sin is and what it does. To alert us to what we who choose sin and rebellion are doing to our hope and our future and our world. But out of his great love, he will permit a stand-in to stand in where we deserve to be, at the place of destruction, at the place of obliteration, who cling so closely to our sin. The people of the Bible understood that God allows a substitute to take our place, a lamb, a goat, a bull, to, as it were, die the death that we deserve, pay the price we should pay, as a symbol of a deep truth. As the writer of the book of Hebrews makes clear, it's not perfect, but it saves the day for the hapless sinner, powerless to withstand the fire of God's holiness. Now that's a hard idea to get our head around, especially if we take a conveniently relaxed attitude to sin. What's all the fuss about? Sin is just bad stuff people do and we all do it, so what's the problem? But the Bible warns us, however we might try to minimise its awful effect, as far as God is concerned, sin is intolerable. It spoils everything. It wrecks everything. And so it must be done away with. Simple as that. Final and unyielding as that. And if you're determined to hold onto your sin really tight, watch out, that choice will have repercussions. That's reality. Thank God, by the grace of God, the blood of a sacrifice is allowed to serve as the expiation to remove the stain of sin. And that reveals that the sacrifice idea is about being serious about God. We dare not assume that we can cheat God as me old mate with the easy familiarity of those who have nothing to hide and nothing to be ashamed of. That's not reality. He's not some old indulgent uncle who wouldn't harm a fly and who cares nothing about how we live or what we do to his world or whether we do what he says or not. The stark awfulness of the ancient sacrificial practice of the Bible makes it clear that we should not view God as some kind of soft touch who will forgive without demur, because that's what he does, the kind old sweetheart that he is. You wish. The Bible is unremitting in its clear accounts of God as fire and might and searing holiness, who will wreak havoc against those forces that challenge his truth or seek to undermine his power. Not because he's belligerent or insecure, but because he is who he is. And his holiness cannot and must not be diluted to suit our wishful thinking. Which means that our status is not that of those who have a right to march into his presence. Oh no. As deliberate, determined, rebellious sinners, we have no right to be anywhere near God's presence. That's the reality. And this raises the question, so what kind of religion are we up for? Something discreetly harmless on the edges of our lives, the blurred boundaries of our concerns? Or a faith that burns like fire in us. A commitment that won't shrink from, but will rather seek the challenge. The wholehearted love for God and for his church that is expressed in a willingness to make sacrifices. To refuse to count the cost of belonging to him. Or to let hesitancy and regret and looking over our shoulder at a much easier life be our style. Taking our faith seriously will involve making sacrifices. It goes with the territory. And also it raises the question of what we think about our sin, how we view it. And I feel a bit of a rebuke here for me as a reaction against a model of church in years gone by and certain styles of church still today, where people were browbeaten and harangued from the pulpit about what washouts they were. I tend not to bang on about how bad we are, how hopeless we are, how wayward we are. So much so you might think from services here that there is no problem, not nowadays. But of course there is a problem with sin. And most importantly, the way it tempts us to keep God at arm's length, to our loss and our cost. Until we feel, understand, acknowledge that we have a problem, there's something not right between ourselves and God, then we won't understand the need for the gospel and the debt we owe to Christ for winning our salvation. Until we see that we are sinners saved by grace, then our songs will have a humanist generality about them, the power of positive thinking, rather than being the grateful thanks of a delivered, saved people. We may not slaughter a trembling lamb as a demonstration of our awareness of our sinfulness, but it is a verdict and a status we do well to acknowledge. This is who we are, sinners saved by the grace of God. This is why we sing the songs of the liberated slaves. And the whole point of it all is the key to everything is the way we feel about God and the way we want to feel about Him. So that no matter what He requires of us in terms of our service, our time, our resources, it's no sacrifice. For love changes the dynamic and explains the willingness to be involved in self-giving. When we love the Lord, working for Him may well be inconvenient. Supporting the life and witness of His church may indeed be a costly business. But because it is for Him, we do it with a glad heart. We do it because we want to build up His church, tell His glory to the world, express our gratitude for the hope He brings us. It's no sacrifice. Hello, Mrs. Kirsten Singer.